All right, y'all. Welcome to another episode of Strength Academy Podcast. It's Mundo here. I'm once again joined by Grayson, and we have a special guest for you. And Grayson is going to go ahead and introduce him for us.
Yeah, today we have America's strongest physicist, Dwight Luman. This is based on a solid 5 minutes of Googling before I got here. And I typed in strongest physicist, and nobody else came up. So I'm going to make the claim about Dwight. Yeah. Welcome to the podcast, Dwight.
All right, thanks, Grayson.
I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk a little bit about some of the science stuff that you're into, and then a little bit about powerlifting and kind of how all of that's kind of come together for you. But what was the, let's start with like general fitness background. What led you into doing powerlifting?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was actually thinking about that on my way over. I don't know if I have a good answer, but I'll start maybe from 15 years ago or so. I didn't do a lot of athletics or anything fitness related growing up. And then at some point in my mid-20s, I kind of started running. And I don't remember why that was, if it was a health issue or just bored or whatever, I'm not sure. But anyway, I started running a little bit and got into fitness, and that just made me feel better, my body feel better. And so I kind of liked it and I got into it. And I started doing a lot of running. And then at one of my, at a previous job, I lived in Minnesota in a small town there, and there was a running club. And so I started running with a group of guys there, and that was a lot of fun. And I was all right at it. I enjoyed it. I was pretty good at kind of the intermediate range distances, so 10K or whatever. But the hard thing about running is that you get a lot of overuse injuries. And so you have a lot of knee injuries, and there's nobody really there to coach you, right? You just go out and run. Everybody knows how to run, or thinks they know how to run.
Yeah, that's a little closer.
Anyway, so at one of my coworkers at that time had started doing this boot camp class. I worked at a college there. We had a multi-use gym, and somebody there ran what he called a boot camp class. So I went and started doing that with him, it was sort of an interesting class. So it was held in a kind of like a yoga studio, and so it was a lot of just body weight stuff and push-ups and that kind of thing, core. I remember very distinctly my first class, because the sorest I have ever been in my life from working out was from that class. So what he had, one of the things that we had to do was a push-up pyramid. You do one push-up, and then you kind of sit up and put your hands over your head, and then you do two push-ups and repeat that kind of air press. And you go up to 10, and then you repeat 10, and then go back down. And I had just been running up to that point. I did that. And the next day when I woke up, I could not move my arms. I really struggled to even get my arms high enough to shave and all. It was really, really bad.
Just so I'm
like,
unprepared.
Like, all right, I got to get better at this. That was the message that gave me. So I started doing that. And that was kind of about the same time that CrossFit was becoming popular. And the guy that taught the class was getting interested in CrossFit.
Okay.
So he started... I started doing these one-on-one training sessions with him, and he started experimenting. I knew this later, but he started experimenting his CrossFit, CrossFit things with me. And so we started doing the barbell and that kind of stuff, and that was kind of fun. And then I ended up here in New Mexico visiting, and he recommended I go to a CrossFit gym. So I started doing that and just got more into it and liked it. That's where I met Grayson and eventually Mundo. And I did that for, 3 or 4 years. What happened is, so during CrossFit, you tend to get a lot of injuries. So I had rotator cuff injuries and things like that. And the other thing that I kind of started to get frustrated with was I was pretty good at running and body weight stuff, because I'm not a very big person. So I could do pull-ups till the cows came home, or whatever. But my deadlift was stuck, and I've been stuck at 365 for a long time, and I was really frustrated by that. So about that same time, somebody at that same gym, started getting a strongman, and I'm like, oh, I want to get stronger. This seems fun. So I started experimenting with that at the same time of doing CrossFit, and that was a lot of fun, and we did a couple competitions.
You did two or three?
At least two, maybe three. I actually don't remember. I remember two, so one up in Farmington and one down in El Paso.
Okay.
And the one in El Paso, we were doing stone loads. It was the fifth event of the day. And like I said, I'm not a very big guy, and Strongman is full of big guys. And so the weights were probably a little bit out of range for me, but that was the first time in my life that I deadlifted 400 on that. It was on an axle bar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's good.
And anyway, so at the fifth event of the day, it was stones over a bar, and it was a 240-pound stone. I went down to pick it up, and I just felt this little pop in my hamstrings. It didn't hurt or anything, but it just felt like my muscles had moved. And I said, oh, that's weird. So then I tried to pick up the stone again and decided that was a bad idea. So I had pulled both of my hamstrings pretty bad. And so from there, I said, all right, Strongman maybe isn't the best thing either. Right. It's kind of an injury factory. So anyway, I kind of got disillusioned with CrossFit. Really liked the strength stuff, so I started powerlifting. At that time, there was somebody at the gym that was interested in coaching that. And that's the long story of how I got started, I think.
That's really good. A lot of people move on to sports because, I think, or different sports because they get bored. But it seems like you're like, oh, no, this probably isn't the best thing, like, to remain injury-free.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I kind of wanted to bring up and that Grayson had to ask was that as a lifter, I think that you've maintained the ability to be injury-free for probably the longest and the most consistently out of all people in the gym that I've known.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, like, what is it that allows you to either dial things back or know when something's like, oh, something's not right, I'm going to back off on this, and
yeah,
then keep that injury-free status going?
I think part of that is, as I sort of explained, is just a lot of experience of being injured.
Right. So, well, yeah, unfortunately.
Yes.
But anyway, you know, and I think as you're going through CrossFit, you know, you beat up your body a lot, or weightlifting, whatever it is, you get pretty sore.
Right.
But there are also times when you just do things like, you kind of feel like, yeah, my body's not quite right, but I'm still going to try to do this. And then you regret it later.
Yeah.
And I've tried to keep it that in mind as I went through. And that experience of blowing out my hamstrings, which took about 4 months to come back from.
I remember that was one of the first things we worked together on, was trying to find some exercises to rehab those pulled hamstrings.
That's right. And I think, you know, at that competition, I remember it was, so most strongman competitions don't have five events, and it was the end of the day. I'm like, yeah, I really know I should warm up, but I'm too tired to do it properly. And that's why I injured myself. And so having been through those experiences, I also had a rotator cuff injury, which took many, many months to recover and rehab. And just going through those experiences, paying attention to your body, knowing what is good pain and bad pain. And your body, I often have learned, it will kind of signal when it's about ready to give. And just learning what those signals are and then respecting them.
Yeah.
So not doing stupid stuff,
yeah,
which is what I view like the first 8 years of my
yeah.
my fitness career. Just learning from mistakes,
right.
and really listening to your body and not pushing it when it's not ready, I think is the key. And in addition to that, I think one of the things that I've really worked on when I started powerlifting is mobility.
Okay.
And being very vigilant with mobility and stretching. And when you stretch, your body tells you what's not right.
Yeah.
And so you can learn a lot doing that as well.
So do you have any ways that you explain or give a little tip to differentiate between the normal, my back aches because I did deadlifts yesterday and that's fine because I'm just sore, and separating, like, what's the distinction between that and this is something I need to back off? What's, like, the threshold for you?
Yeah, I think, well, for an experienced person, you've experienced with, or you've lifted or done whatever with soreness a lot. And so you know what that feels like. And so that, to me, at least in my experience, tends to be kind of a dull pain. And it also, I think this is really critical, it's something that as you warm up, it should dissipate.
Right.
Yeah.
If you have a pain or something that's uncomfortable that doesn't dissipate without, as you warm up, that's bad. Yeah. You should just stop whatever you're doing.
Okay.
And I really learned that, when I pulled my hamstrings. So I was, as most people are, I was really upset at that time. And like, I want to keep lifting and stuff. And so I was trying to find ways to do that. And I eventually stumbled upon the Bill Starr philosophy for injury recovery.
What is that?
This is a really great thing. Okay. It's fun.
At least in my case, I would phrase it in the following way. So I hurt my hamstrings, so squatting was going to be really hard, or deadlift, but right. We'll just say squatting. And so his philosophy is, okay, you hurt yourself, you know, you did something traumatic to your body, give it maybe a day or two to kind of come back, and then start moving.
Okay.
And so in the case, if you're trying to rehabilitate a squat injury, you'd be just starting with a barbell and doing sets of 10 squats.
Okay.
Maybe 3 days after you pulled your hamstrings. And the criteria is you keep going if, as you do the squats, your pain feels better and better and not worse and worse. If it gets worse and worse, you started too early.
Right.
Okay. I caught on to that maybe a couple weeks after my injury, and that's when I started it. But I've always kind of kept that as a philosophy during warming up, that if your body isn't getting better as you're warming up, there's something wrong.
Right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and I can see how that could be useful information for a lot of people out there that, you know, kind of just throw whatever on the bar and just start going for lifts. So.
Well, and that's, a very good argument for if you're warming up for, you know, like Dwight's powerlifting workouts, he'll take 135 as many times as it takes to feel good before working up for the day.
Yeah.
And it's the same idea with weightlifting, where it's, if overhead squatting the bar isn't comfortable yet, keep doing warm-up sets till it feels good. And if something's wrong, you'll know after 10 warm-up sets, you know. I think that, yeah, being really thorough. But that Bill Starr technique is really... it works rather well. I've done a similar thing for when I pulled my back at University Nationals from trying to lift after driving all day, which was just a great idea. I was like, I'm going to do good and actually exercise while I'm out here. And then I pulled my back overhead squatting 60 kilos. And I was like, well, I guess there goes that whole thing. But the most important thing was just to keep it moving. And like, if you have a back tweak... this happened to one of our other lifters. They had a small pull in their back, and then 2 or 3 days later, we had them come in, throw a band over their shoulders, and do banded good mornings, and they left the gym feeling much better than when they came in, and you slowly kind of reintroduce the movement.
Because
I think one of the things with injury is that people stop doing whatever it was that hurt, and then the fact that they stopped doing it makes them afraid of it. And then it makes it, you have like two problems now. You're losing flexibility because you're not getting into position, but you're also just scared of squatting under the weight. Now
you have a mental barrier.
Yeah. So now you've got two things to work through. Yeah.
I thought that for me, so when I blew up my hamstrings, it was both hamstrings kind of on the inner side, just above my knee, all the way up into my groin, and there was a lot of scar tissue that was starting to build up that isn't very pliable. Starting to move again really helped with that as well.
Along the lines of the mobility thing, I thought this would be kind of an interesting thing to talk about. I know that you've done some rolfing in the past, and I feel like that's a thing that people have heard the word a lot of times but don't really know what it is.
Yeah.
That's not like referring to the Muppet Babies thing, like Rolf.
I do not think...
Oh, Rolf.
I could be incorrect, though.
Rolf was a regular Muppet, too. He wasn't just a Muppet. Yeah. He was the dog that played the piano, right?
Yeah, he was the one that played the piano, yeah.
It's a very talented animal. So, yeah, what was your experience with rolfing, and just kind of what is that, and do you feel like it was... like a very powerful placebo or a very helpful tool? Like...
Yeah. Well, again, let me start why I did Rolfing. So one of the injuries, the overuse injuries that I did, or that I got a lot when I was running, was my foot would hurt. And it didn't seem to quite be plantar fasciitis, but it was something similar to that, I suppose. And it was one of the reasons I stopped running. And when I got into CrossFit, that was fine for a while. And then eventually with box jumps, and in particular like farmers carries or walking under really heavy load, that all that foot pain came back, and it was a big problem. And so since it had recurred, you know, over many years, I thought, all right, I gotta try to get this looked at. And if you go to a doctor, they're just gonna say, oh yeah, let's do surgery. And so I wasn't really into that because I didn't feel it was necessary. So I ended up doing Rolfing with somebody that I knew from the gym here in Albuquerque. And she had just started up a Rolfing practice. If I remember right, when you start doing Rolfing, they suggest that you do this 10 treatments, or you go 10 times, and it's a whole series of treatments. So I'm like, all right, yeah, I'm up for anything. So we started doing that. And what Rolfing is that it's named after somebody whose last name was Rolf.
Okay, that makes sense.
I don't think it was the Muppet, but...
All right.
Anyway, basically what it is it concentrates on two things. So one, it's working to release your fascia. It's not so much muscle release, but it's fascial release. In addition to that, what Elise did, which was really helpful for me personally, was to figure out what in my body mechanics was causing the problem. And so we did a lot of me just walking around and moving my arms and things like that.
Right.
And so she did a lot of body work, which was really helpful, very painful, but very helpful. And then she gave me a lot of tips of like, when you walk, do this. When you stand, do this. And that was really helpful for me. And what was amazing to me when I first started doing that, so like the walking thing is, remember that you have four hinges that are being used when you walk. You've got your toe, your ankle, your knee, and your hip. And you want to use all of them.
Okay.
And so a trick to try to do that and to keep your toes straight when you walk is to think about pushing off your toe every step that you take. Hmm. And so I have to walk around at work a lot, and so I would do that as I'd wander around at work. And I could tell as I'm doing that over the course of a couple weeks, I could feel the muscles in my legs like rearranging. Like I could feel as I was walking, like, this is a little tight in a funny way, you know, like in my quad or something. And then over time that went away and my body mechanics got much better.
Hmm.
And overall, I think that's really been critical in avoiding injuries and stuff.
Right.
As I've continued to, you know, pursue weightlifting. But every time I get, you know, we all have these, you know, funny pain that shows up, and like me, it's in my hip flexors over the side of my hip. And if that starts to show up, I know that my walking has gotten off and that I have to focus on better walking.
Okay.
And so I learned a lot of things from Rolfing in addition to all the fascial release and the, you know, the immediate benefits.
Okay.
So
that's really interesting. I like that it's focused around like identifying where the faults are in the movement patterns and then kind of building things up from there. The walking thing is, like, personally for me, I know I've been yelled at by my PT for, you know, because I'm kind of, you know, duck-footed or whatever
right.
you call it. And, you know, she was, like, doing some assessments. She's like, well, part of the reason that you're having trouble with your squat is that you can't move your big toe, like, at all. Your big toe is, like, I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. So then I'm having to focus on walking and pushing off of your toe. And it hurt like hell for like a week. Like my toe joints were getting really sore because I wasn't just kind of rolling off the ball of my foot, but actually trying to walk all the way through. So yeah, make sure that you're walking with your toes forward.
Yeah, and I mean just long term, independent of fitness. You know, if you're not using those four hinges, what most people do is they just swivel at the hip. Right, so that's what like shuffling is. Right, you're just using your hip, and that's why a lot of older people's hips wear out. Is because they're not walking properly and they're just overusing their hip joint.
Huh.
So just for life purposes, you know, it's good
practical
too.
Movement.
Yeah.
And the thing is like, a lot of times people don't think about the way they sit, they don't think about the way they walk, they just shuffle along or they're just hunched over all the time. And like, we spend a lot of time on our phones or our computers and things like that. So with that hunched over posture kind of affects, it goes into it crosses over into things that you're trying to do sports wise too, like your activities for weightlifting. So it might be that shuffle or that gait that changed, you know, increased your lifts by allowing you to be in a better position and helped you, you know, stay injury free. So it's like if people would be more cognizant of those things in their daily lives, that might have some carryover into their sports.
I completely agree. Yeah, definitely. And it definitely, again, I think it's a good injury prevention because it uses all the muscles in the way they're supposed to be used.
Right.
So.
Okay.
But I guess with keeping with training, so like what, for you, what purpose does powerlifting serve for you? Like what do you get out of it? Why is this kind of like, is it, you know, that it's in line with kind of the scientific thinking you like to do, or you're kind of, you know, using yourself as an experiment, or is there, you know, like what is the appeal to strength sports for you?
I don't know. I think that for me, in some ways it's this isn't entirely true, but in some ways it's orthogonal to science. For me at least, or my day-to-day science. It's not true in a way that I'll get to in a second, but for me, you know, at work I spend a lot of time thinking and dealing with hard problems, and I just need time where I don't have to think. Just sit down and relax. And for me, coming in to the gym and powerlifting kind of fulfills that, where it just, I can just sit there and not do anything and get up and do a lift every 5 minutes or whatever.
Right.
And so from a day-to-day perspective, I think that that's a really important part of my day, just to kind of keep me balanced. And keep it, it's also a part of my day where I'm necessarily disengaged from work. So that's important. Now, the part that it's not orthogonal to science is the part that you mentioned, Grayson, which is that a lot of weightlifting is just figuring out what works for you and doing experiments and things like that. And so that's kind of fun. I just naturally find that fun. But so that sort of scratches that itch at the same time. But I think overall for me, it's just like a way to relax and decompress. Well, at the same time, it challenges you physically, right? And it's hard. And for whatever reason, that's appealing. I don't know.
well, it is appealing because maybe, and I know I've mentioned this before, is like there's a lot of, as we move toward a society that's more reliant on technology and getting away from discomfort, there's some aspect of ourselves that still likes to do difficult things.
Yeah.
And that's physical or mental, there's that aspect sometimes that becomes missing because of the things that we're headed towards. And I think that weightlifting, powerlifting, and fitness are things that people can use to endure difficult things without putting themselves in different dangerous situations.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
It's very safe as far as thrill seeking behaviors.
Yeah. That's right.
A few of the I spent the morning researching a few really kooky things that are tangentially related to your career. But would you just kind of give us a preface of like what's your PhD in, and what kind of stuff that you do within the science realm, and then you can kind of help us make fun of some of these quantum mysticism things.
Okay, I'll look forward to that. So for me, my scientific career, let's see. So I did my PhD. So I should start. I'm an experimental condensed matter physics physicist. So I'm on the experimental side. I did my PhD in superfluid helium physics. So what that is well, first I should say that everything that I've done throughout my scientific career has been really, really cold. So near absolute zero, and that's, I don't know why, but that's one of the things that I enjoy and find interesting. My PhD was looking at the superfluidity in liquid helium and various properties of that. Now, once I finished that up, there wasn't really a career path doing that. So I so I changed fields, and I got more into semiconductor physics for my postdoc, working on fractional quantum Hall effect, which I'm not going to explain.
Sounds complicated.
That's another podcast.
Yeah, that's a series of podcasts. So that got me into semiconductor physics. And then eventually I got into working on the fundamental physics of quantum information in using silicon, and in particular using electrons in silicon. And that's kind of what I'm working on now.
So you're like a comic book superhero, Dwight, because like you're a physicist and you lift heavy weights. Like, and it's not, you've competed at multiple levels, but like I think that you've been able to reach a level of strength that most people aspire to, and then you're also a physicist on top of that. So it's like we're basically talking to superhero guys. But as far as like your work goes, do you have an analytical approach to how you look at your training and things like that? And like, it sounds like you do a lot of problem solving during the day as well, but do you look at your training that way? Like, I'm not excelling in this area, or something's plateauing, how do I, you know, get around that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, going back to what we were talking about before, when you're doing a lift and you fail at it, or you don't do it well, or you're not hitting the weights, you know, you really, or at least I do, I try to spend a lot of time thinking about why that is, or what's missing, or what's weak in that, and then trying to put the pieces together of how we can fix that.
Right.
And so it is, weightlifting is much like physics. It's just a lot of problem solving. And what's hard about it is that there are a lot of variables,
right?
And you don't know what those variables are, and you don't know all the time, you don't know what they are, or how to address one without, you know, is it this one? They're correlated variables scientific jargon. But so the other thing that's interesting about weightlifting is that, so you identify something, you want to try to fix it, and so you come up with a plan to try to fix it, you don't know if you've fixed it until like 3 months later.
Right?
So you're kind of during that time always collecting more and more data and using that to see if it's proving your hypothesis or not. At least that's sort of what I do. Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, and then you have to go back and rethink.
So do you look back at your training journals and say, well, this changed and it caused, like, this cause and effect type thing, where, you know, this changed in the past and then it created this effect in the future? Is that how you look at it? Is that why you keep a training journal, and do you ever like refer back to it?
I do refer back to my training journal to see what combinations of lifts we were doing. So if we were doing deadlift, what kind of accessory work we were doing during a period that we made a lot of progress. Things like that.
Okay.
So or what rep and sets, you know, sets and rep schemes we were doing.
Oh yeah,
because we've tried over the last, I guess we've been kind of working together on your powerlifting program for like 2 years now, something close to that.
Almost 2 years, yeah.
And we've done a wide variety of things, just kind of trying to find, is it worthwhile to do sets of 12 for 3 months before getting into some heavy lifts? And no, if anyone's wondering, no, it's not worth it. It's good for hypertrophy gain, but but it was very hard to get the strength back. So we've been kind of doing a lot of trial and error. And what's really fun about working with you on these is that because you keep good notes and you're very in tune with what you're doing, we can collaborate very effectively on, like, okay, this is the area that, you know, you're feeling a little bit off in, and okay, well, let's try doing, you know, implementing these two different exercises, and we'll see which one actually feels good.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one thing that surprises me a lot with Grayson is that we often have the same conclusion.
Well, that's good.
So what I'm feeling while I'm lifting, I guess, is what Grayson is seeing while I'm lifting, and we're pretty in tune, pretty resonant in that sense.
So would you say that that resonance is a function of spooky action at a distance allowing us to read each other's minds? So this is one of the, so I thought that the, instead of doing a hardcore philosophy corner, we're going to, touch on, because there's a lot of what I'm going to call quantum BS. In the, because we do a lot of talking here about, you know, consciousness and decision making and, like, you know, just kind of fun philosophical things. And what a lot of people, it seems, are trying to do is fill the God of the gaps with quantum physics. Okay. So there's guys like Deepak Chopra saying that because of the double slit experiment requiring an observer for the outcome to change, that consciousness is what's creating reality, and that reality would not exist without an observer. So let's start with the idea of, they call it new physics, and I think that we could start by just, what have you ever heard of these, like, kind of new physics ideas?
No, because they're all a bunch of crap. So let's step back a little bit. So quantum physics is perhaps the most tested theory that has ever existed in humans' knowledge, right? Okay. So it's something that was developed mainly in the 1920s, in the early 1920s, to describe some specific experiments that weren't able to describe classically. And basically what it is that you can think about it that instead of energy coming in a continuous spectrum, it comes in little packets or quanta. And so everything is quantized, basically. Meaning it's discrete in steps. Now those steps are very, very small. And we don't experience them in everyday life because all of our energy scales, you know, like in terms of moving weight and things like that, or just living, are much higher than that. So it's so we don't experience it. So it doesn't fit with our intuition. Now, along with that, there are other strange things that come along with it, like wave particle duality. And you mentioned the double slit experiment. Which is a quantized photons moving, or one at a time, moving through a slit and moving through two slits. And depending on how you measure it, that will act like a particle or it'll act like a wave. So there's that. There's also the spooky action at a distance that we have the, can thank Einstein for that particular phrase.
It's very poetic.
Yeah, so Einstein's in it. Sorry, this is going to get off topic a little bit.
But that's referring
to quantum entanglement, right?
Yeah, quantum entanglement. Yeah. So Einstein's really interesting because he kind of kicked off quantum physics in 1905 when he quantized the electric field. Quantum hadn't been invented yet, but he did that and was a big advocate. And then later in his life, he did not like quantum physics. He thought it was bad. He did not believe it. Etc. And so that's how this spooky action at a distance. How do we describe that? So that's basically quantum entanglement. If you'll let me, I'll try to describe what that is in just a couple minutes. You can take two quantum mechanical objects, so two photons or two electrons or something like that, and you can prepare them in a state where they kind of know about each other. And then in the case of photons move; they don't sit still. So one photon might be moving to the left, and then the other one might be moving to the right. Now, when you measure one of those photons, the state that you measure, there'll be some statistical distribution that will determine what state you measure. So either, let's say, it's a left-hand or a right-hand photon. And then when you measure that one, that automatically determines the state of the other photon, because it has to, in this case, has to be the opposite. So if you measured a left one, it had to be a right-handed one.
Right.
But that photon is far away now. So that's the idea of spooky action at a distance. And also the idea of when you measure something, you change its quantum state. So before you measure it, if it's a quantum mechanical object, it can be kind of what's called the superposition of two states, which means that when you measure, you've got a 50% chance of measuring state A versus state B. So all that stuff is weird. It's beyond our intuition. But for it to work and for it to be projected into everyday life, like consciousness, they have to be quantum mechanically entangled objects. That, what you were describing, has nothing to do with quantum mechanics.
Yeah, fair. It seems like the argument that they're trying to make is that the ion channels in the nervous system, like the sodium potassium channels and like the microtubules within the like neurons and clusters of neurons, that they're trying to say is that they're small enough to experience quantum effects, so that there's, so they're thinking of it as like the brain is like a quantum computer, and that's why we can't really like solve the hard problem of consciousness of, we know what the structure is, but we can't really say what this experiential aspect is. And I think it's kind of interesting that they're trying to fill it with that, but I know that just based on talking to you at the gym a couple of times, that's very much not, none of that is really implied through...
Yeah, nor is it possible. I mean, one of the hard things about doing quantum mechanics is that it's this idea of a measurement, right? So if you create a quantum state, once you do a measurement, you collapse that quantum state into whatever the, you know, whether it was a left-hand or right-hand thing in the photon example. So what does it mean to do a measurement? So you can be a physicist and have some kind of detector and have a clicker, and yeah, okay, that's a measurement. But if you also think, what did you say, sodium atoms or ions?
Yeah.
Sodium ions in the brain are surrounded by a lot of stuff, right? Like other cells and atoms and liquids and fluids. And one of the hard things about doing quantum mechanics is that all of those stuff, all of those surroundings act like a detector. So it's really, as that, let's say we had a sodium ion that was in some quantum mechanical state, as it's interacting with its environment, it's losing its quantumness because it's essentially being measured by the environment.
Oh, okay.
And so it's really, really, really hard in condensed systems like the human body, meaning where atoms are close together, to maintain quantum coherence. And so that's why it just doesn't make any sense to me.
So it kind of, it loses some of those qualities with, it's like sufficient complexity, kind of brings it out of that like realm of operation.
It's the interaction with its environment. So is really what it is.
Would loading a barbell kind of be an example of that? Because you have weight on one side, right? But it has to be balanced by weight on the other side at an equal distance. Otherwise it throws the whole system off.
No,
okay.
I don't think so. Right.
That's just how I was trying to understand it, and I was like, okay.
No, it's literally just the interaction of a quantum state with its environment makes it essentially classical. You lose all the funky quantumness of it, the entanglement or the superposition.
Okay.
And I mean, maintaining quantum coherence is very, very difficult, and that's what's needed for, you know, doing whatever. Quantum computation or whatever you were talking about.
Right.
So, yeah, it's, to me, it's not worth thinking about because it's just so absurd.
Right.
And if you think back throughout history, quantum mechanics has always been trying, you know, people have always tried to exploit it for various reasons because it's weird and it's beyond our intuition. We don't understand it. But at the same time, it's real and it's true in certain things.
So it's been injected into lots of kind of hokey...
Yeah.
Or it's like, it's not a pseudoscience, but the way that people explain it and try to use it is.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I thought we'd end with a pretty... one that we've kind of talked about on the show before, but I'm very interested to hear what you think. So if, you know, I kind of want to talk a little bit about free will and determinism. Because I just find it really interesting that, so if we can say that the majority of the interactions in the universe are cause and effect, there's, you know, a precursor and one thing affects another, you know, the bowling ball hits the pins move.
It's deterministic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you think that, you know, if we live in a deterministic universe... Do you feel like that regardless of what the sensations we have in our day-to-day lives, do you feel like free will and free will in a determined universe is compatible or incompatible?
Let me push back on the assumption. So the assumption is that we live in a deterministic universe.
Yes.
And so it's a very classical way of thinking. So I'm going to contradict kind of what I said before, which is one of the very difficult things about quantum mechanics is that it's not deterministic. It's probabilistic. And it's a, so it's, when you think about it, it's a fundamentally different way of thinking about life and nature. And now, what I said earlier was that most of the things in our lives are not... quantum isn't relevant. But, you know, quantum mechanics for our day-to-day lives is more or less the overarching theory that determines everything. And it is a probabilistic theory. So, I don't know what that has to do with free will, but but it is a probabilistic theory. And I think, I have, to be honest, I haven't thought much about this at all. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to come up with a cogent answer to your question, but I don't know. I don't quite know how to respond to that.
I think maybe explaining like the part that I find kind of interesting is that, if your decisions that you make on a, daily basis, the feeling that you could have chosen otherwise, but you don't have a way to reliably go back in time to see if you would have chosen a different option. Mm-hmm. And whether it's, strictly determined or probabilistic, all of your decision-making is kind of based on your experience from the time you were born to now. Mm-hmm. So some of the arguments that I find kind of interesting, kind of against compatibilism, is that the sensation of free will is there, but we have no way of really testing to see if you could have chosen to do something different today, how large the scope of like wholesale changing who you are as a person tomorrow is really kind of a
misnomer. We can't do the experiment because of the arrow of time.
Yeah,
right. It's always pointed in one direction. Right. So I think that. So I'm gonna be honest about this.
Yeah,
I don't think about it because we can't do the experiment. So in some ways, it's irrelevant.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, like why bother yourself with the details if you can't change any of them?
Yeah, that's right. Now I think that's different than saying we shouldn't learn from our past experiences and use them to inform the future. But to me, free will exists, right? Because we make decisions.
Yes.
And your point is how do you know you're really making the decision and you're not just on some predetermined course? I think that's the question.
Right? Yeah, essentially. Like a very complicated, but that, has all of the feelings of decision making, but is really kind of just based on your experiences and who you are, that's the decision that you'll make.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so to me, that's just how life is. That's just how you have to operate.
Well, I think that's a really good point in that whenever I hear people argue about this or try to make their points, it always kind of seems to me like, well, yeah, we maybe can't say that, like, libertarian free will is, like, 100% true, but the only way to live in a functioning society is to operate as if free will was a thing. Really no way to live your life not making decisions, because whether or not you could have made a different decision doesn't really matter at the end of the day.
Right, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
There's only one way to
It's not that. A particularly useful problem to spend all of your time thinking about.
But an interesting one nonetheless.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. How are we doing on time?
We are at 43 minutes.
43? So, all right.
Is there anything else you wanted to ask? Because it looks like we covered quite a bit. So
yeah, I have one more kind of fun thing that you might be able to help us understand a little bit, and that's the idea of the like kind of multiple worlds.
The fractal universe.
The multiverse.
Multiverse. Yeah. Is that a bunch of bunk too, or is that...
I can't say that one way or another. So the idea with the... this is well beyond my realm of or my expertise, but let me step back a little bit. So, you know, I'll step back to Plato, all right? So, okay. All right. No, I don't. But, you know, if you think back to kind of once humans started to have the time to think about why they're here and what around them, you know, what it all means, mm-hmm. they've been trying to explain the universe and the world that they live in. And that has evolved over time, and that's sort of moved from philosophy, natural philosophy, into physics over time. And as physics, and so there were all sorts of religious-based theories, you know, and stuff like that in the old days. And then as time has went on, you know, physicists have tried to do this, and it's a really, really hard problem to explain kind of why the universe is, why all the, you know, why the dark matter and dark energy that we I guess, don't observe, but we know is there, why it exists and why the universe is expanding and why the particles that we have in our lives, like electrons and protons and things like that, exist, and why they have the masses that they have and the physical properties that they have. And so those are really hard problems. And so people have worked on that, you know, kind of through the 60s and the 70s with the standard model. But people keep finding, which is super solid, but at the same time, people find little glitches where it's not quite true. And as time has went on, the theories have gotten a little bit more exotic, let's say, to be able to explain specific things, because there are always things that we're missing and we can't quite figure it out. And so we have these more interesting ideas. So, you know, and then string theory came along, and then, you know, there's ideas of the multiverse, like you mentioned. And I think I haven't thought about this in a really long time, and I've never known much about it, so take what I'm going to say with a grain of salt. But the basic idea is that from a probabilistic standpoint, there has to be more than one universe, right? And there have to be more dimensions and things like that to be able to explain all of this stuff. And I don't think that we have a test for that. So one of the great things about physics, I think, is that if you have an idea and you have a theory, you can test it, right? So experiment, nature will tell you what the right answer is. And at this time, we don't have tests for that. But unless there are compelling reasons to just throw it away or not, you know, you have to kind of keep it out there as a possibility. But as you get more and more advanced in thinking about a theory of everything, or a TOE, as I like to call it, things get more and more abstract and really difficult to think about. So the multiverse falls into that category.
Okay, so that's kind of like an overarching explanation.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know the details well enough to say much about it, other than it's not the universe, right? It's the multiverse.
Right.
And how do we know that there aren't more than one, you know, or whatever? Right.
So we can't disprove it, but we can't really prove it at this point either.
At this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And it must explain something. I don't quite know what it is, but it must explain, help resolve some unanswered question that we have in physics. That's one way to do it. You know, it's just like, so string theory, for example, the only way string theory works is in 11 dimensions. But we work, or we live in three dimensions plus time, three spatial dimensions plus right. time. So, what's up with that? So people do like dimensional compactification to try to get rid of those extra right. eight or seven dimensions
the
that they have.
Ones, right?
Yeah, and condense them down into this. And so that starts to sound kind of science fiction-y like.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's things people are working on. It's really advanced ideas that people have. But, of course, the criticism with string theory is that there's no experimental test.
Right.
Yeah, that's so people are still kind of, you know, operating in so there's kind of like, it sort of seems like what you're saying is there's kind of like practical ground level, like how do we make this work, test and retest, kind of like making small discoveries, putting small pieces together, but there are still a handful of people trying to get that theory of everything kind of top level stuff done, but it's kind of a dead end when you try to explain everything.
It's been a challenge for a long time. I don't know if I would say it's a dead end. I'm not that pessimistic about it.
Okay.
I'm pretty pessimistic about it, but I don't know if I'm that pessimistic. But it has taken people into stranger and stranger places. as they start to think about stuff. It does seem
like humanity, a lot of times, will get a hold of the ability to do something before we understand how it works or the ramifications of using something, you know. And so a lot of times, like, we might be able to figure out space travel, or maybe we'll have a hyperdrive engine or something that propels us through space faster, but we won't understand exactly how it works. We'll make it work, but we won't understand exactly all the mechanisms that are involved in making it work. And I think that that might be the case with some of these theories, is that, you know, we're trying to understand the overarching reasons of why things work or why things are the way they are, but we just, we have what we have to deal with at the present time.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, it's not that they're not worth doing. Right. There's history, you know, this history of science is full of people having crazy ideas.
Yeah.
And then that maybe in the end they didn't turn out to be true, but they led in a direction that was very fruitful.
Right.
And yeah.
Okay. Well, hopefully we're doing that with weightlifting too.
Yeah.
having a somewhat scientific approach to making people stronger. But it's been a fascinating conversation, Dwight. Thank you for coming on and explaining some of these theories to us. And your background as an athlete as well. It's been really good learning about that. You want to add anything, Grayson?
No. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Go ahead and like the show. Give us a 5-star rating or write a review. That helps us out a lot. And Dwight, thanks for coming on.
All right.
All right, y'all. Until next time, happy lifting.